The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 235 for Friday, 9th July 2010. My name is Jim Race. I'm here in California, and with me back again, and I'm back again, is Martin Darlington over there in the UK. How you doing, Martin?
I'm very good, back from Catalonia, and last weekend, nicely tanned from it, fantastic weather, as everyone will have seen on telly, and thoroughly looking forward to this show.
Excellent, excellent, and you say great weather, but it was hot as Hades there, was it not?
No, I mean, it was, in centigrade, it was lower 30s, it was 32 to 35.
Okay.
There was a bit of a gentle breeze, it was almost perfect. You are in a bit of a sun bowl, sat inside the circuit. In the arena, so yeah, I mean it was fairly poaching. The track temperature at one stage was well up in the 40s. Good for the grip. Goodness knows what it felt like for the riders, but yeah, and we've come back. England had lovely weather, or UK had lovely weather whilst we were in Spain, and we've come back and it started raining. So
yeah, it's the UK's version of welcome home, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this week we've certainly got a whole lot to talk about, and I will profess my own ignorance, or not ignorance, but haziness, because of my absence last week and my unavailability of internet connectivity. I did watch the races, but they're very hazy, so Martin is going to be driving that portion of the show today. I do have an interview that I'll be doing with Michael Siz right after Martin and I get off the phone today, and I have a feeling that's going to be really cool, because Mark Miller actually provided me with an amazing series of questions, and I've certainly got a whole bunch of my own. I actually polled a few other people that are in that particular realm, and I have a feeling it's going to be as long as one of our shows, Martin, but you and I can't go more than about an hour, because that one may go an hour as well.
I'm sure from a lot of the listener feedback we've been getting, the general consensus, apart from the one chap we had who was mainly complaining not about the length of the shows, but the fact that we sometimes mention bike racing other than MotoGPAD, goodness help us. Most people are like, no, the longer the better.
Yeah,
I quite agree. Within the realms of, reasonableness.
and we even have people sometimes saying we should do two shows a week, and there ain't no way in hell that's going to work. But we did have a bunch of listener emails. Why don't you run through that, Martin, because yet another fantastic week and input from our listeners.
Oh, yeah. No, there's been some really, really good stuff this week. I mean, let's face it, we're not short of topics at the moment. This is probably the silly season to end all silly seasons. The first one, Brandon Bashaw, was the first person who brought my attention to the upgrades received by Randy Depinier. It is now across MotoGPOD and LCR's, MotoGP.com. and LCR's website, but HRC have given Randy Depinier's team a new chassis and various other new bits and pieces.
And I tried pretty hard this week to get them back on the show, both Ceccanello and Depinier, and unfortunately they haven't got back to me yet. I have a feeling their popularity and media access has probably tightened up a little bit, but I will continue to do so, because we had them on, what was it, back in May, right? Something like that?
It was early June, wasn't it? It wasn't that long ago, certainly. And yeah, I mean, he comes across, the people who interview them come across as saying he's universally popular, but he's almost, he has a dual personality, quite shy and retiring off the track, on the track. I mean, we were just saying, here comes CSF, crazy sideways Frenchman. Watching him throughout practice, he is... it's almost like watching, in a different way, Elias when he was in MotoGP last year. You know, he has a very, very distinctive style, and it's just full-on entertainment.
Yeah, but, you know, you make an interesting point about that with Tony, that Tony was always kind of a mercurial rider, and Randy has had, you know, some very interesting up-and-down seasons, and he's come on, clearly very strong lately. And I will note that that was right after you talked to MotoGP OD. We seem to do that for writers, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah, we are the good luck house. Come and visit.
Come on this show. But yeah, that was very cool. And we'll have to see, because he's also a huge part now of the silly season rumors for 2011.
Absolutely. And no doubt we'll mention that later on. Old friend of the show, Jamie McVeigh. He's not old. I'm sure he's very young. Expat Australian living in the UK. And Jamie wrote, and these are his words, "I could rattle on about this for ages, but I'll be brief." That's not something that I can relate to, but if Rossi is going to Ducati, what happens to all of Stoner's mechanics? Where does Hayden fit in, considering he actually this year has a bike he likes riding? Brackets, would he get a more Rossified bike, seeing as Rossi will hold the clout? What if Jerry B doesn't want to go, considering the work it may involve and Lorenzo is the future? Who knows? God, I wish I worked in the paddock. Well, as Jules replied to Jamie's email, Ben's guys are going to be, presuming this all happens, Rossi goes to Ducati. I don't think there's any doubt. I think Jerry Burgess will move with him, and when Rossi retires, Jerry will retire. I can't really imagine another scenario, which means Tom Houseman and Ben's team will move up into the Fiat team. Some of Casey's guys might go with him to Honda, because I'm sure Livio Supo has a wish list of the people he wants to nab. And the good guys who are left might, from the factory Ducati team, might migrate to the Pramac garage. You know, generally, I'd imagine it's a bit of a magic roundabout that, okay, someone gets pushed out of that team. If he's decent, he'll get picked up somewhere else.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And it always cracks me up when we end up in situations like this with these type of silly season things going on, because essentially what happens is everything goes into vast speculative mode and people are always trying to figure out or second guess where things are going. And I used to totally be into doing that. And after a while, I just kind of settled into a, well, let's just wait and see what happens, because there's clearly nothing that I can do to influence it. And while, you know, I've made an awful lot of guesses in the past about what was going to happen that didn't come true. And at a certain point, I was like, I'm just going to watch.
Oh, the amount of hot air I've blown into the atmosphere over discussing things over which I have no control, very little knowledge. You know, it's been said before, I've got opinions on things I've never heard of. But, it's fun, but... Yeah, I think, I remember Liam talking about it is quite a brutal environment, the paddock. Okay. If a rider moves, he takes with him the people he wants and the team he goes to. If he's a rider who can dictate terms, and let's face it, if anybody can, it's Valentino Rossi, then the team he goes to, some of those guys just told, sorry, off you go, which is why there's year-by-year contracts for them.
Very true. True. Yeah, and you know, here we are. This is Thursday when we record the show, or at least this week it is. And yesterday we had Rossi at Misano, right, testing. Or yeah, maybe Rossi. There was a whole internet conspiracy theory going on that wasn't even actually Valentino Rossi. It was, you know, somebody else.
It's interesting you say that, because someone pointed out they didn't exactly keep it secret. He's there in his full... you know, leathers, in his helmet and all that. It is a kind of obvious smokescreen, but there are journalists there who know him, and the way he walks, the way he rides, the way, you know, you'd sure think someone would have... Yeah. I love conspiracy theories because they're such good fun.
Although somebody pointed out that he was looking through the corners more than he had his traditional, basically looking straight down at the rumble strip.
Front wheel, yeah. It's still going round.
You know, it would be fantastic if they pulled that up. I actually heard somebody say it was probably the Stig.
Yeah, the Top Gear Stig strikes again. Yes. You can buy t-shirts over here saying, "I am the Stig."
All right, let's keep going.
Yeah, we had a very interesting email from Papa Thiam, or Papa Thiam. And I do apologize, Papa, if I've misspelled your name. He said, "Hey guys, I was listening to your discussion on the last podcast about why Yamaha should absolutely retain Rossi's services. Now, I just, as Martin, I would like to point out here, that's not exactly what I was saying, but I know what he means." Papa goes on, "I'd actually given it some thought over the weekend and came to the conclusion that if my brain automatically associates Giacomo Agostini with Envy Augusta, the same thing will happen with Rossi and Yamaha. in my opinion, unless he wins a couple of championships on the Ducati, he'd be remembered as a Yamaha legend in the long run. Just like I'm convinced that Michael Schumacher will be remembered as a Ferrari driver, even though he came back to drive a Mercedes. Yamaha would be foolish to let Lorenzo go just to appease Rossi. Now, this is a theme that's been going on for ages, and I mean, I'm very aware that this is a sport. Mm-hmm. The thing we love is a sport, and sport is not, or fans of sport are not given to objective thinking. You know, we allow our emotions to cloud our judgment. You know, the amount of stuff, and I'm not going to go through it in the length I've written it in the show notes, but there was a letter to Motorcycle News from some TDS, he's called himself. Tedious, I presume that's short for. The guy's an idiot. He said, you know, what Yamaha playing at? If you had to choose between Rossi and Lorenzo, it wouldn't take you very long to decide. And then he says this cracking sentence, regardless of how good Lorenzo is on a Yamaha, he'll never be able to match the greatest rider ever. Well, we don't know that. I would argue, yes. You know, it's very unlikely we're ever going to see in the foreseeable future, it's unlikely we're going to see someone with Rossi's charisma and talent and skill. No, I quite agree. But he's just said, regardless of how good he is, well, what happens if Lorenzo wins every championship from now till, he's 23, isn't he? So the next 13 years, so till 2023, he wins every single championship. I think that would probably nail him on as the greatest rider of all time. Yeah. We don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it very well could, and we don't know what's going to happen. There's a whole bunch of what I kind of, at least in my mind, term is muppeteering right now. You know, everybody's got their own emotion and a complete lack of objectivity when it comes to the riders like. And when there's situations like this where there's something up in the air, because we really do have something up in the air, some of the stuff that people say and write and whatever, and especially the relatively instantaneous nature of being able to post on the net, has changed the whole journalistic aspect of road racing to a vast degree. And it's actually a much bigger thing than people think. You know, people think that at least GP is kind of small and there's not that many people paying attention to it. Well, that's absolutely not true. And there's a lot of people online that are talking about it. And it's fun to read, but sometimes I just shake my head. I'm sure you do the exact same thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of the guys who were with this weekend, you know, who are big Rossi fans, and they're very good friends of mine, and I think a couple of them listen to the podcast, and so I'm probably going to get phone calls tomorrow or on Saturday complaining. But they were saying, well, there's no way that, you know, Lorenzo's going to be as good a development rider as Rossi. We don't know.
We don't know.
He may not be. He may not be. But we don't know. He's done pretty good so far. Double world champion at 250. He must have had some input into at least the setup. And I would say at the moment, and this is the point that I sort of made in the show notes, which I won't go into in as much depth as I've written it there, but I was a bit exercised at the time.
You were
at this moment. Well, yeah. At this moment in time, I would argue there is evidence, not conclusive, but there is evidence that at this moment in time, Lorenzo is a better rider than Valentino Rossi. There you go. I've said it. The hate mail can begin. I would not argue at all that there's evidence at this stage that in 20 years' time, he'll be remembered in the same category as Rossi. He'd have to go a heck of a long way to prove that or to earn that. But at this moment in time, he's on the rise, and due to the human condition, inevitably, Valentino Rossi is going to do nothing but decline. He may be able to maintain his level for another few years, but you know, it's back to the old thing that the discussion had with John Hart. Valentino Rossi is the greatest of all time at this moment in time, but he can't be the greatest for all time anyway.
Yep. So that's the perfect point, is because time goes in all directions, not just backwards.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And the whole thing about Yamaha, and do they bow to Rossi's demands and kick Lorenzo out? I mean, how stupid would they look if he did go to another team, Rossi stayed, never won another championship, and Lorenzo went to Ducati or Honda and won the next three? I don't think it's going to be up to Yamaha. I think it's going to be up to Valentino Rossi. He'll decide where he's going. He'll decide.
And all the other chips will fall into their place. That's
yeah. And that's why I'm gutted for Lorenzo, because it does look like he's going to be deprived of his opportunity of beating Rossi on the same equipment.
Yeah, but like you say, Mark, we still don't know. Everything could be in a very normal state for next year, and we never know until later in the season. So I'm still in just kind of wait and see mode. The only thing that I would question is, I wouldn't question it. I understand the rationale behind it, or at least I think I understand the rationale behind it, but why Rossi is working to come back as potentially quick as Sachsenring, but what is the actual motivation behind that? But I think I'm going to leave that for another day, because probably next week's show, because we're going to know more next week. And that has been the story of the day for the last 48 hours anyway. You know, people just freaking out, grabbing pictures, getting all the information they could. He ran relatively decent times, and that was basically on, I believe, Cal Crutchlow's R1 from the World Super Squad. And it was nice seeing Graziano there. That was very cool. We'll try and have a link. There's a story on MotoGPOD. There's a longer video there. There's another video that I put on the MotoGPOD Facebook page about an hour ago that has some video from YouTube from the MotoGP folks. And so check that out, and it's cool. And God, I love the sound of that R1, especially when it burbles when it's off throttle. That is so cool.
Yeah, I started hearing them at track days last year, and it was sort of somewhere between the traditional inline fours and the V-twins. But yeah.
I've
got
to
be honest.
It sounds like a triple. It does.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and of course there isn't a modern large capacity triple racer, because Triumph, you know, they got the 675. There isn't a FAU or 1100 sort of equivalent at the moment, which would be interesting if they decided to do it. But I've got to be honest, then you hear a GSXR coming down, you just or a Blade, and you think that, no, for me, there's something about the howl of an inline four that just screams purpose.
You know, I'm kind of the opposite way, but then I'm an oddball unto myself. I like hearing something that sounds a little bit unusual, and to me, the unearthly howl of the R1, even though it is an inline four, but it's got that cross-plane crank firing, just sounds weird enough to set my teeth on edge in a good way, and I'm all good for that. We also got. And I'll keep us going here. We also got an email from Nick Codling, and Nick writes in all the time, talking about big fish in a small pond, Melandri, Dovey on the satellite bike, Randy DePunier, you know, is he able to make more changes in factory teams? And I thought that was an interesting question to pose.
Yeah, I mean, this came in literally a few hours ago, and this was a result of the discussion that Jules and I had when he was saying, you know, Dovey really, really impressed everyone when he was on a bit of a dog of a 250. Then he went with the Scott team his first year in MotoGP, goes to the factory team, and was there a bit of a Melandri syndrome where Marco at Gresini, fantastic, you know, MotoGP winner, runner-up in the World Championship, he goes to Ducati factory team, disaster. Goes to Hayate, no one expects anything, he's fantastic, at least for the first third to half of the season. Now he's back at Gresini and he's starting to make progress again. I mean, that, considering his injury, that was a blooming good result at Catalunya. He got a good round of applause every time he came round. So Nick was suggesting, is it not just what we were talking about, like the pressure of expectation, but is it the fact that when Melandri's at the Hayate team, no one expects anything. The team there have got a bike with very little in terms of technological development. So does that give him more power to say, look, let's try this, let's try that? Whereas when you go to HRC, they say, no, we'll tell you. Now, obviously, Marco hasn't been there, but Dovey as the example. He goes to HRC and they say, no, we'll tell you what parts the bike's going to have and how it's going to be set up, and then you just fine-tune it. So is there more freedom for these guys to have an input? And maybe we're seeing that with Randy DePunier, you know. I mean, I loved that line of Lucho's that all I did was ask him to stop crashing because I was going to start taking out of his wages.
In my thought, what I think is that, this is going to get me in trouble too, but I can't help but this being my personal feeling, that the RC212V is kind of at the end, not the end, but yeah, the end of its development life, especially with the new rules coming up. And much like the RS250, the Honda RS250 in the 250 class, or the Aprilia RSA250, there's not as much attention being paid to it except to the very top riders. And the rest of the guys, or at least those that can actually show very good results, are not going to be getting development parts, because what's the point of developing a bike that's essentially going to be obsolete in a year, right?
And this is the problem with Suzuki, isn't it? They're not going to throw a whole load of money at the 800 when it's not going to be here in 2 years.
Yeah. So I think the answer, my answer to Nick, and I read what you guys said, and I think my answer would be, maybe I'm sounding like a broken record this on, but we kind of just have to wait and see. I think things are really going to be shaken up, and one of the things, you know, once we go to this new engine formula, which is going to be a bit of a nightmare, but I think things are really going to change. And once again, we're going to have to completely observe and revamp what our thoughts were on what are going to be the competitive bikes. We knew what happened in the first year of the 800s, and nobody expected it. You know, they came out with the Ducati came out and just blew everybody away, and people were like, oh my God, we're in trouble. And it took this long before, well, you know, up until it took a while for everybody else to catch up. And the M1 is now kind of acknowledged as the prime bike to have, but there's no doubt that Nicky Hayden, and as well as Casey Stoner, are still having excellent results on the Ducati. And we see, you know, the Honda occasionally run away with Danny doing his rabbit run. So, you know, that's what makes doing this show fun, Martin, is everything's going to change again. We'll have a million new things to talk about. All right, we should keep going here, because I do need to get in touch with Michael Siz in almost exactly an hour. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to move through time once again here, and we're going to go ahead and play the interview, which neither of us have heard, Martin, because it hasn't occurred yet.
Okay.
And then we'll come back, and we'll talk about Catalunya and all the other news that's going on. So let's roll that in. Hello, this is Jim Race for MotoGPOD, and on the line with me this week, I have Michael Siz of MotoSiz up in Oregon. How are you doing, Michael?
Good, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing great, and thank you so much for joining us. We had Mark Miller on 2 weeks ago, and that led me to definitely want to have a chat with you, even though I've actually wanted to talk with you for about 5 years, and we finally got it together, and Mark was nice enough to give me a fair amount of questions, and so I'm just going to kind of launch in. Your project has been going on for quite some time. Well, projects, I should say, because it really is a multiple amount of them, and certainly over the last year to 2 years. But I do want to ask, and this is one of my favorite ones from Mark, was he said, I need to ask about the watch.
First, let me ask you. So is Race really your last name?
It really is. That's actually my last name.
That's cool. It's not like Lady Gaga, you didn't make it up or something?
No, not a pseudonym. I mean, you're not the first to ask that. In fact, I actually said that one of the reasons that I wanted to go racing myself was so that I could put Race on the back of my leathers. And the first year that I raced, I had people I could hear them laughing behind my back going, that's really stupid. And the next I had people apologize because they realized that it actually was my last name.
Yeah, MotoSiz would be much better off if my last name was Race as well. you know, if there was one, snapshot of really how cool and generous and really focused on motorcycles Mark Miller is, I think it's about the watch. So this is just how weird things kind of all come together. Flying over, some point, I think it was on the small flighty plane, and I'm actually quite claustrophobic and don't really like those short or small plane flights. So I was there with all the, you know, distractions I could possibly get my hands on, and eating and drinking and radio and or iPod. And I was flipping through one of the magazines, and there's this really cool ad of this cool watch, and it was a TT, Ironman TT watch. And it was like, oh, my God. And it looked absolutely like a Hublot or Panerai or just one of those really great, large, military, masculine watches. But it was cooler because it had the three-legged logo kind of as the second hand. And I thought, oh, my God, if we win this race, I think I should, you know, this is maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I tend to have not celebrated enough on the ups, thinking there'd be more ups, and, of course, I've experienced a lot more downs than ups. And so now I'm the one that wants to, you know, any opportunity on any kind of upside, make sure we take knowledge of it. So I thought, well, if we get this win, maybe I should buy this watch. This would be great. I'll have it give to my kids and so on. So we get there, and I talk to one of my other teammates, and I think he must have seen the same ad. He was saying, oh, yeah, we should do the same thing. I'll get one. Maybe they're, you know, $1,000 or $1,200 or $1,500 or something. I mean, we kind of made this pact. Okay, we do that. Let's get these watches. Well, later we found out they were like 8,000 pounds or something, like $12,000 or something ridiculous. And we're going, well, I guess we won't get our victory watches if we win in the end. As soon as Mark Miller or I finally get to the area where the bikes are pulled in for the post-race kind of interview and photo session, and by the time we get there and give them all the high fives and hugs and we're all feeling good, a guy comes from around the corner dangling this watch right in front of him and says, here you go. They give him this first place cap and they give him the wreath and they also they hand him this watch. And we're going, holy crap, that's the watch I just saw, you know, a couple of days ago in that magazine. And I was so happy for him. I had nothing to do other than I just couldn't believe. I was just so happy that finally electric bikes had been elevated and that he had won and that he had got, you know, the watch and all the stuff. The dinner that night, and this is another story I'll tell you about after, but the dinner that night, he presented me with the watch and handed it to me. And it's just, he couldn't have done anything more genuine or anything nicer or anything more touching to me. And in fact, the watch is actually still there being sent, and every day I hope that UPS box shows up.
You know, I've seen that exact watch that you're talking about. And it is very, very cool. I have a Tissot Moto GP watch, and yeah. And just, you know, with the tracks all around the bezel, and it's like very, very cool. That's neat. That is a very good story. I do have to ask, and I wonder about this, because I know that there is a race coming up, another race coming up at Laguna Seca, and I will be careful to tiptoe around this, but are you going to run it yourself? Are you going to race that yourself? Because I know that you're running the racing school there with Skip Barber, right?
Yes, I am. Well, I wanted to do it. Obviously, my biggest concern is, one, will I be fast enough? More important for the bike to win than for me to, you know, ride the bike and win. Sure. And two, every time I have gone of late to some kind of event and haven't had to be the main guy like you would be at a race or at the event, I'm always thankful. Thank God. You know, I'm already stressed. I'm already overwhelmed. Thank God I don't have to also do that.
Right.
So I kind of did some work down, being at the Skip Barber School and helping the other students elevate. That does actually help you elevate.
Sure.
And have been getting around that track fine. Had Eric Bostrom come up and do a guest instructor position for us a couple weeks ago, and we went out during one lunch, and he pretty much gave me the thumbs up, no problem at all, circulating the track. And then I just finished 2 days of testing the bike. And so at this point, I probably actually am the most experienced person on the bike, can get around the track, have submitted all the paperwork, and assuming that there's no hiccup, I do plan on racing it in about 2 weeks.
Right on. Now, let me ask you a question. And I'll be there, so we can chat again then, post-race.
Cool.
But there's got to be a certain amount of nerves that just gets doubled, because not only are you the patriarch, if you will, of the team, the bike, and everything, but now you're the racer. It's almost like going back to the days of club racing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not a good combination. There's a reason why racers are racers and team owners or managers are that. It's simply too much too much information and there's not enough bandwidth and you can only compartmentalize so well. And it, you know, they're the antithesis. The racer prior to the race should be 100% focused on his upcoming task, which is the most important thing. And simultaneously, usually the team boss or team manager's position is kind of peaked with its intensity just before the race, making all the decisions. So there's a big conflict there. But, you know, obviously it's not the highest level. Certainly every year after this, I will have less opportunity to do it. And I just wanted to do it. This whole travel for me, this whole process has been about, you know, not being adverse to taking risks and simply really going for it. And I think this is just another one. I'd like to sign off there. I think we've got a great chance of winning. And it would be as nerve-wracking and difficult as it is, it would be more rewarding to actually have the success. So I think, you know, it's worth one shot.
It's kind of for me trying to figure out how do you would actually take the bike and change it from a TT type bike to a short circuit. Although I guess in retrospect, they're really not that much difference. The TT is just one really long race that happens to have all a bunch of corners that don't repeat. But there's certainly things that you would have to change. Are there a lot of changes that you need to make to the bike, especially, you know, like hauling up the hill from say 5 to up to the corkscrew, and that's going to be draining some serious battery power.
Yeah, actually, you know, it really is interesting. We have a lower level, but the same number of problems that all the other teams have. We've got to worry about which tire choices and, you know, center of gravity and weight bias and all of our suspension settings and spring settings and throttle mapping and, in our case, regen mapping as well, which is, you know, another level of mapping. But we have to worry about something they don't, and that is effectively our energy and our weight bias or our overall weight of the energy we want to move on and then how we utilize that energy. So it is motorcycle racing plus. And there is a difference between running at the Isle of Man and the short track. In the end, the distances will cover less distance during the Laguna Seca MotoGP event than we would at the Isle of Man.
Right.
But we will be accelerating way more often and absorbing much more of that energy through the brakes, you know, turning it into heat. So our efficiencies are actually down quite a bit. The cool thing about it is if battery density could really make a reasonably significant leap, and I'm saying the 4 to 8 times, you would actually configure the bike significantly different between the two, just like you might dream to do if you had a motorcycle where you could say, well, I only need 3 cylinders for this track, and the other track I like 4, and then this track I like 2, and you'd get the weight benefits and some of the potential torque or top speed benefits of doing that kind of configuration. So we're not quite there yet. We kind of still need pretty much all the battery we can get on board. But, you know, for one thing, of course, the number of turns, the braking, and the suspension in particular is really different. You're running half motocross, half road racing bike at the Isle of Man.
Right, right. Absolutely, and especially as soft as you have to set the suspension there. It's amazing how plush the bikes end up needing to be because these are basically real roads. That's what they are.
It's honestly, you cannot know until you've physically been there. And luckily, the first time I went there, I ran right up to Mark's bike, and I just said, hey, can I get on your bike? Can I just feel it? And I was just kind of bouncing around. This isn't the most, you know, the best way to at least get some insight, but it was one way. And I could not believe how soft the bike was. Immediately we went back to our bike last year, set it up, what I thought would be more comparable, went out to, gave it to him. He came back, really no concerns. I went out to Jerby, and I was bouncing around like nuts. And I said, but is this racetrack that much worse? You know, by how much worse is this racetrack than the actual TT course? And said, oh, no, it's about the same. I said, you've got to be kidding. So we did a spring and a shock change, and I gave him the bike the second day. That was in much better position. So clearly when we came back this year, we had a better understanding, but not a perfect understanding because we still had ground clearance issues with the suspension settings as soft as we had them.
Yeah, and that was a concern. Mark, Mark said something which I kind of laughed at because I knew it wasn't true, but it was just an excellent exaggeration, was the thing weighs as much as a Goldwing.
that's right. It's an exaggeration. But, there's a lot of things that give you the perception of weight. And frankly, I didn't have the designed steering geometry that I wanted on the bike due to some ground clearance issues. And also, this isn't a build like the C1, but there's still several hundred parts involved. And there was a clearance issue on one or two parts, and we just ran out of time. I couldn't quite get the geometry right. So it was heavy and a little bit slow to turn, and maybe the weight bias wasn't quite right, and dampening wasn't quite right. Well, you add all those together, all of a sudden, it does feel like a Goldwing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you were relatively close to 50-50, but the weight was a little bit higher than you would have wanted, right?
The weight bias was perfect, exactly what we wanted, well within our parameters of adjusting it. Actually, it was not too high of a CG at all. The bike is ridiculously stable. We simply just didn't have the overall ride height on both ends correct, and the front dampening was way off.
Yeah.
I'll
leave it at that, too. And at some point, maybe not today, maybe at another time, I'd like to talk to you about your front fork setup because that just blows me away. Why did you guys switch from the old C1 double dampers on the back to a single?
Yeah, I still believe that's a better solution. It's really a packaging issue. To me, and this is why, one of the things that people have a problem with, or one of the suggestions they like to give us is, hey, maybe you should, go slower and just take an existing bike and just put your front end on it or just put your rear end on it.
That's no fun.
Okay. Yeah, there's some valid, that is valid to some level, but it's very cursory and very kind of low-level testing it because everything affects everything. And so when you're doing a bike that is, or a motorcycle that is such an integrated vehicle, you could be spending, as months, 6 months, years, or whatever on the front end, but the minute you change something to the front or to the rear, it affects the other. So in our case, on my list of priorities, suspension arrangement is quite low because actually I kind of like that. It's very mechanical. It's very easy for me. We've come up with now several different functioning rear scenarios. And in this case, of course, the priorities were batteries, which we've never had as a priority before. Then the motor anti-squat, geometry, steering, all that type of stuff was second. And way down the list was where the suspension components go, because like I said, I feel like I can really handle those and put them anywhere. And when we got through our list of priorities, all of a sudden it was like, wow, there's really no room to put the damper where I had it on the C1. In fact, the electric motor is there. I'm going to have to move it up. I don't really mind doing that. I looked at moving it up into the airbox and other things, but couldn't come up with a convincing of enough reason to do it. So where I ended up kind of putting it was like, God, I really can't justify now pulling the springs off and adding the complexity to it. So yeah. I'll just make a simpler unit this time due to all the other parameters. It has nothing to do with this being better or worse. I still think the dual spring is far superior, but in this case, it made more sense.
Well, on the other hand, too, that also leads to the possibility, since it's not a bespoke unit, for you to have a sponsor that takes care of a really sweet suspension kit.
Possibly.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Actually, I've got a whole raft of questions. I have to keep these in order, but are in my mind. On the C1, and speaking of the dual suspenders, you did listen to Mark's interview, so I know that you know this and you know that I'm going to ask it. With the rule change in MotoGP going to the 1,000cc bikes, do you have any plans to revive, rebuild, reshape the C1 into something that might compete at that level?
Well, I would love to say absolutely have a plan, and we do have a plan, but we have to, obviously it takes money to implement the plan. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, we're gaining a lot more traction on the electric side. The electric side needs a lot more help. It's less refined. It's more appropriate for a small company to come in and have a bigger impact with less money than it is if you go to the ICE side.
Right.
So from a business standpoint, everything is indicating that we should continue to work on what we're working on. And, you know, if the phone called, if the phone rang tomorrow and somebody called up and said, hey, you know, we've got a sponsor, we've got a rider or an organization, and we'd like to move into MotoGP, and we think you've got the right package, in a heartbeat more than anything, we would have to seriously look at what we would stop working on to pursue that, because that is still my number one goal. And it's hard to say that and say, yeah, well, our number one goal is, you know, a little bit on the back burner, but honestly, that's life. And the other thing is, so that answers your question, I hope, specifically, but just outside or in addition to that, we have been over time, you know, the biggest thing about the C1 was the counter effects of the gyroscopic forces, mm-hmm. and the roll and the torque effect. It's a combination of those. And the orientation of the crank removed the gyroscopic, and the splitting of the crank canceled the torque effect that you would otherwise get, like in a BMW or a Moto Guzzi or the new Modus.
In words you guys had, and I've seen this used, but I like the term, although I'm not sure exactly how precise it is, but it was perfect balance.
Well, the balancing has to do with, frankly, the primary and secondary forces due to pistons and rods and all that. But I don't want to take, you know, this is too big of a subject to go into, but what I can say is that there was really a notable feeling and result from that crank and that configuration. It just got validated further. I just spent 2 days on the electric bike, and of course that has, it does have a rotor, but in the location that it is, and the overall width and the RPM that it is, which is much, much lower in our case than the crankshaft would have been, the overall gyroscopic forces are less, and the bike is simply magical that way. So one, it makes me feel like what we were working on the ice side was valid, and we should keep doing it. But on the other side, it's kind of like, well, you know, that was great, a great solution for that type of problem. But maybe there's a bigger problem in front of us, and maybe, you know, this oil thing and the energy independence and making more efficient vehicles is, in fact, a higher problem. We're kind of getting the benefits of that twin crank right out of the motor if the motor's put in the right spot. So all of a sudden, I'm kind of getting a little bit of the best of both worlds. I'm kind of still feeling like I'm keeping some of the C1 validation alive, even when we move towards electric.
Well, yeah, and there are parts that are still applicable. Did the demise of like the FB Corsa project and the Elmore X3 kind of sour you a little bit?
Well, I mean, I think it throws, you know, cold water on the situation. I mean, there really is no reason. I mean, all those projects, and even, you know, Honda's project or Ducati's mm-hmm. project, it's still individual men or women that are, you know, have come together, and there's a leader and there's a concept, and they work through it. I mean, there's nothing magical. There's the entity Ducati or the entity Honda didn't come up with the machine. It was the individuals that were there. So any group is just as likely to be have the ability to do that. Of course, the sanctioning body around them, the Honda and the Ducati, give them the means and the support and the money and all that to do that. So there's the big difference. But so I don't want to say that it's not possible, but obviously when you see companies like that that have a much better chance than we did as far as resources and budget fail, you got to start looking at yourself going, well, you know, yeah, it's possible, yeah. But is it likely, and how difficult is it going
to
be?
And to be honest, and it's interesting, Martin, I just had a discussion on this. You really don't know what's going to happen, especially when the FIM or Dorna changes rules so drastically and your target is moving. And, you know, you had a 990 built and then they went to 800s. Well, that screwed you back then. But regardless, let's talk about the electric bike a little bit more, because I've got a few there. Did you guys manufacture your own batteries, or did you guys outsource those?
Well, the batteries are kind of, again, this is because of the new industry. Let's just define the term a little bit. When we talk about batteries, we talk about a unit that can store and deliver energy. Within the battery are individual cells. Mm-hmm. So we do not manufacture the cell. There's only so many, you know, handful of cell manufacturers in the world.
Right. You package it.
We package it. And that would be like saying, we don't make the chip, but we actually build the computer. And there's plenty of big computer companies, Dell and the likes, that don't make the chip. The chip might come from Intel.
Sure.
So yeah, we did the batteries in-house.
Okay.
In fact, I'm
sorry, go ahead.
On the latest bike, it was quite a family affair. My wife came in and did his, you know, a fair amount of work. My 12-year-old son was in here cutting tons and tons of nickel, and I personally welded all the batteries together. There was about 6,000 welds, so
a lot of
work.
Your father was also involved too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, but he wasn't allowed in the battery room.
Okay.
So he was out working on the bike side of stuff.
That reminds me of that one little bit from the Charge trailer, Mark Neal's movie that I hope comes out soon, and everybody is hoping it comes out soon, with the thing sparking off when it was on the dyno.
Yeah, that was a low-level spark. We're immune to those. If that happened, I probably wouldn't even notice. We're much more used to much higher, much wider flashes of light than that one.
Okay. I can picture that quite easily. You've got a bit of a Tesla coil going on in your dyno room. I do have to ask, what are your plans for next year's TT? Going back?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Okay.
I mean, even let me just say one thing about that. I, of course, was aware of the Isle of Man. Of course, I watched the videos, like most of the racers. Until you experience it, obviously you haven't experienced it. And it's an incredible mixture of traveling a long ways away for us to a small little island that has a kind of a resort feel to it, juxtaposed with this event that is as mind-blowing as any motorcycle event is, yet the next day is off, so you'll wake up and have your tea and go down and walk the promenade, and everybody who's selling any product down there, be it a chocolate croissant, and she's 80 years old, still knows the results of what happened the day before. The whole island is submerged in this event, but so there's this casualness and this intensity, and it's just intoxicating. It's an incredible place to go to.
It's like a big 37¾-mile amusement park that also encompasses all the players that are there. Yeah, I know so much about it, and I've never been there, and it kills me. It just kills me.
Yeah, a guy like you should go. I mean, you go to MotoGP or you go to World Superbike, and it's pretty awesome. You fly in on Thursday and you leave on maybe Sunday or Monday, but the level of intensity is typically so high that the entire time that you can have a friend in a paddock garage and, hardly have time to have a conversation with them over the 3 days because they're so immersed in what they're doing. At this event, you go there and you're there for probably, 7 to 10 days if you're a small player. You're there 3 weeks if you're a bigger player. It's incredible. So it's really something. This is why people actually can almost a lot of people from Europe plan their entire vacation, their entire year around it, and that's their 1 or 2 week vacation where they go there and set up a tent and hang out. It's quite the event to experience for a motorcyclist, and it makes all the bikes down on Cannery Road at San Francisco, in Laguna Seca.
Oh, yeah. Cheese ball.
It's like, really? That's all you guys have? That's all you got? Because the Isle of Man, there's tens of thousands of bikes.
Yeah, I did one stop on Cannery Row, and God bless you, Laguna Seca and Scramp. I know you guys put on a great event, but I was like, no, that's not what I'm here for. A question, because I noticed that you're not real aggressively pursuing, for example, TTXGP. Is that not something you want to pursue, or the rules not fit quite in with you, or?
Well, we're obviously a very small company, and we've got to pick the events that we think suit us best. And I don't want to get into the politics. There's a lot of politics, and I have a lot of information on what happened. We were kind of, early in on this whole deal.
Okay.
And I think it'll all get sorted out. And, obviously there's still changes to come. And, electric racing at this moment won't be supporting a multiple, I don't think, sanctioning bodies. So, we pick the stuff that we think is best for us at this point.
Okay. One question that I have, and that I'm sure everybody has, is
to the listeners listening, that rant was insane. I'm sure he had to cut it out, but it's going to take him a minute to get refocused. Go ahead.
Yeah, deep breaths, right? everybody's like, please, can we hear it? No, sorry. When are you guys going to have gearboxes?
Gearboxes.
Yeah.
more than one speed.
Yeah. Who asked that question? Was that you or was that Miller or somebody else?
That was both of us. I thought of it, and I read his version, and I'm like, yeah.
So I don't want to answer that one because that's a really good – it's a really good question, and we actually have a lot of insight, and a lot of that would expose our hand on what we are focusing on, the reprioritization or at least the balance of what's the word I'm thinking of? Compromises.
Okay.
That we would have to make. And so I'm not actually really eager to speak about that right now.
Okay. No problem. I believe maybe hopefully we'll see something soon. What popped in my mind once was derailleurs. I'm like, that'll never work. You get 250 pounds of torque. Although, is that real? Do you guys actually get 250?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Let's talk 100%. About your motor. So you're doing oil and liquid cooled. But what's the liquid? Is it just like propylene glycol or something like that?
Something like that.
Okay.
I mean, not to be coy, but obviously we're in an emerging business, emerging industry, I should say. We're in a competitive business. We're 2 weeks away from a race.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, we're first and foremost an IP company, so.
I know. This is horrible. I want to know, and I'm not even close to the bit. Well, I guess I'm close enough to the business, but you know what? We'll talk after if you feel comfortable about it.
Sure. I'll tell you in Laguna everything.
Okay. Mark asked this, or at least he pointed it out, and I want to ask you because I thought it was interesting. He called you a modern Leonardo da Vinci. Do you remember that from the interview?
Yeah, it was really nice of him.
I thought so too. And then he asks, he says, do you sometimes feel misunderstood where you're going with your goals and your dreams and the work that you do for road racing?
What happens is, though I have been, a fourth generation motorcyclist and an avid motorcyclist my whole life, and I mean, really, it has been my number one passion outside of my business. My business was design, and my business was in a field that probably no motorcycles, has followed or knew about. And there was some level of stature created or success created in that business. And that business was, high-end kind of design stuff. And that's a whole different world. It's I don't want to say it's the antithesis, but it is not the motorcyclist demographic at all. So I suspect that, since that was my single pursuit for 20 years and, I was good at it and had really quality projects and clients, that if somebody were, and that's who I was, I guess at some level that doesn't necessarily fit the motorcyclist demographic, and there's a conflict there.
Can I stop you for a moment? I think I would deny that because your background, for those that don't know, is in architecture, and you have a company, Architectros, is that the name of it?
Architropolis.
Architropolis, even better. But there's no doubt that when it comes to motorcycle design, that you clearly have a very sharp eye for the aesthetic, and that applies very well to a motorcycle demographic, I feel.
Yeah, I for sure the design talent transfers over, and I think really a good designer could design anything. They just simply have to understand what the goals are and stuff. But if you're good at balance and proportions and colors and all of that, it is quite easy to actually move. I mean, in Architropolis, it was very common for me to design the architecture, the interiors, all the furniture. We would design often custom components. I would pick out specialty cars and have them built a certain way, or design guitars from ground up for clients or modified. So, light fixtures, I mean, every aspect. I mean, so my design output has been extremely high for 20 years. So getting on a bike, it was like, oh, that's fine. I'm used to designing, hundreds of components. No big deal at all. I'm just saying that the characters that you see on that type of high-end design world are not the characters that you see riding motorcycles.
Okay. Yeah.
There's a gap there for sure.
Sure. That I totally understand.
I mean, it's more, it's much, so that being said, but I will say on the other thing is it is our job as designers, and I take this very serious on the motorcycle world, and that is to actually be working on projects that are, you know, several years ahead of probably where even the general core demographic of motorcycles thinks it needs to be. Because frankly, you know, you're not going to be much of a visionary if you throw out an idea and everybody you talk to says, "Oh yeah, that's what I was thinking. Oh yeah, I agree. That's what should happen." It's like, "Oh God, I'm not really pushing this far enough. I'm not really thinking far enough." So, you know, somebody's got to do that. Now, it's usually done by teams of people in big companies, and they can kind of hide it, and it just goes towards building the brand. In my case, it's kind of individualistic. It's kind of me, so it's easy to say, "Hey, you know, I'm not sure why he's doing that. That doesn't make any sense." It's like, well, right, that's either one, it's a bad idea, that's possible, or two, right, you just haven't been spending the last 5 years focusing on these things, and maybe, you know, we're slightly on a path that's a little bit ahead of where the normal person is, you know, the normal motorcyclist is thinking.
This just popped in my head. Did you ever have thoughts of maybe subscaling the design and creating a chassis for Moto2 last year?
Oh, man, that is what I wanted to do so bad, desperately bad. Are you kidding? That would have been perfect, because obviously the biggest expense to what we were doing was the engine, and to be effectively given an engine, and that we even had a bigger idea that I came up with, that we would actually design the frame, subframe, in such a way that we'd have an interconnect, and that interconnect could change. So theoretically, you could put in other engines besides just the Moto2 600 engine. I thought, this is perfect. This is exactly what we need to do. Okay, so we didn't design the engine, but guess what? I mean, even at that point, Aprilia was saying they were going to race a Moto2. And I said, if Aprilia could race a Honda engine, certainly Moto2 could race a Honda engine. And we got pretty far with a guy who, this is the same story that I'm sure Petronas can tell you, or Kenny Roberts can tell you. I mean, I've talked to Kenny many times, and he's got this story, you know, 10 times more than I have. And I got quite far with a guy that absolutely said he's got the financing, or almost absolutely positive he's got the financing, and this and that and all. And so we put together a budget. We had it submitted to him. We even had a team that could effectively operate it for us in Europe, is that where it would need to be based anyway, as far as the race organization. We were going to do the R&D here, and I had even talked to a couple of racers. And then, you know, the emails and the phone calls just come less and less frequent. Before you look up, you're going, I guess this isn't going to happen. And this is what, you know, it's very frustrating. In the end, I'm the guy that has an interview with somebody like you, and if you would have asked me that, you know, 12 months ago, I said, oh, absolutely, things are looking really good. We've got this and this and this in place. And frankly, we did.
Yep.
But, you know, the guy came to me, he's got the money, so that's kind of his contribution. And then in the end, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But since I was the one that had the interview with you, I'm the one that looks like, you know, we didn't deliver. Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of pieces in these things. And so we obviously kept that quiet. I would never come out and say anything like that before, and thank God, you know, we didn't. But I really thought we had it. That would have been a great experience.
There's got to be, you know, this is kind of a hard question to ask, but you've faced, besides the triumph that you had this year, no pun intended, you've had to face a fair amount of disappointment as time has gone on. And how do you This is just off the top of my head. How do you deal with that and keep moving forward and keep spending money and keep a team around you that maintains the morale that you need to continue producing good product?
You know, the problem is that we've had some failures, but we've had way more, I would say, positive than negative events in MotoCiz. Unfortunately, nobody, you know, maybe they don't make as many headlines, or they don't get talked about on the forums. But, I mean, read all the articles, probably 100 articles on the C1, where, you know, most of the people who have ridden that bike from test riders down said it's the single best handling bike they've ever had.
Sure.
You know, we'll go back, and we have a problem that any R&D company would have, and you go out, and if you solved it, I mean, that's a victory. That's a win. Yeah, we didn't grid, and we didn't go to the racetrack, but we, you know, solved our thermal problem, we solved our chatter problem, we solved, you know, whatever all those problems were that were in front of us. We've done things with suspension that we haven't seen before. We've done things with chassis that haven't been seen before, with transmissions or cranks and fly-by-wire. And so those are all building morale. Really, the biggest morale killer is simply the promises from others, primarily focused around money or something, that don't come through, because we don't control those. So we kind of get pumped up, get excited, we kind of dream that this could happen, and then it goes away.
And I guess part of it is you're always driving towards, in the end, success at the racetrack.
Faster bike.
Yep. And now that you've had it, I'm sure the team is picked up by that. And you certainly heard the kudos that Mark gave to the team. He made sure to get that in, didn't he?
Well, you know what? I want to counter that, because first of all, I really appreciate what he said, and it does mean a lot. And I hope our guys, and there aren't that many, so I'll walk out and tell each one of them that they got get on the computer and listen to Mark's interview with you. But yes, our team did work hard. They did a great job. The bike was a good weapon. But here's the thing. I mean, Mark got on that bike. He was slightly wrong. I had actually taken it out. It had never seen the day of light until it got to the Isle of Man. It simply was being built to the last second, got loaded into a crate at nighttime, and that, shielded it from the light until it physically got uncrated in the Isle of Man. It had never seen daylight. That night or that following morning, I went out and did about 70 miles on the road, which doesn't sound like a lot, and I can't certainly do the circuit and at that speed, but I was still hitting 120 miles an hour, still going over bumps, still trying to go around corners and brakes. And we did whatever we could to kind of set up for the aisle, because the best analog for the aisle streets at that point for us was on the streets of the island.
Right.
And I don't think we're the first race team to have gone there and parked by some farmhouse and ripped up and down, some streets before.
On top of that, there's an awful lot of cops up in Oregon. You can't really do a whole lot of testing up there.
And I can't tell you how many cops I saw on my own man. And, I won't even tell you all my strategies, but we had one strategy, and it seemed to work out great. And I could just wave at them as I'm going by, like, at 120. So that aside, Mark had never ridden it. And this is the second year that I literally handed him a bike on the pit lane. He had sat on it once and bounced it because we did some sag adjustments. But I already knew his weight, and I kind of used an analog, somebody in the office that was his weight, and kind of got there. So literally, besides him sitting on the stand and sitting on the bike, he never turned the throttle until he got on it. I don't care how much work we did or how good we are. That takes an amazing guy that has trust and intellect to be able to at least talk him through. I mean, we spent a fair amount of time emailing and calling. I had a few questions here and there that most of the questions I do look at from a writer's perspective, and I can answer on my own by myself. But there was a couple that relayed to the Isle of Man and maybe his riding style or his preference that I would run by him. And so we did build up a dialogue and a narrative about the bike, but he didn't turn the throttle until he got on it. And the head down Bray Hill, I think he had hit about 120 down the first, within the first mile.
Yep.
It's incredible. It's an incredible feat, and I don't think many riders would do it with the poise and confidence that he did, and lack of, additional emotion that could be generated. We just simply got there and started working on the problems and delivering. He did a great job.
That's the just turn the throttle and go. Yeah, just turn the throttle and go.
and that was, I know, a silly clip, but that was the reality. I mean, that's exactly, I mean, he knew a lot about the bike, but it was just like one. I mean, but that's how new the bike was. So one more confirmation that, are we ready? Is it running? Do I just got to turn the throttle and go? And that's right.
Well, and for our listeners, and as you mentioned, I know that Mark did talk to you a fair amount, and he had some input into the bike. I know that he pushed you guys to have like hydraulic rear brakes, right?
Yeah, we do have to have. Then we were talking about how we separated them, but yeah, we came up. Yeah. I did. I certainly ran by him and said, what would you like? And he told me his preference, and we absolutely built it. In fact, the second bike, he didn't even ask, but it was from me spending time with him on the first year, where we had a little bit of, you know, the tanks are hollow shells now, obviously.
Right. Sure.
And you have to even question, you should you even aesthetically have a tank? But the tank also serves a lot of contact points between rider and bike. So we need the tank, or a shape that's similar to the tank. But the first one, because of the hollow shell, didn't have the connections that it should have had to the chassis. It was more of a shell, more of a cover. And, you know, that doesn't feel good when one of your contact points can shift a little bit. It's miscommunicating to you. So the second bike, without even asking or whatever, I presented him the bike and said, look, this subframe and the tank is all one piece, and it couldn't be more rigid, couldn't be more stable, and it is fantastic. So
that's cool. Well, and you know, part of that is the same thing, not only about aesthetics, but aerodynamics. And I know you guys have done a decent amount of wind tunnel testing, and you had the classic, which I was involved in, the what I called the dustbin dust-up on your website. And I know that you guys were pondering, if necessary, to have a dustbin fairing at the TT. And I saw mounting points for fairings on your bike from, I think, Asphalt Rubber maybe got some spy photos and Amadeus Photography. And I'm like, oh, they got something up. But you guys never did use the dustbin, and you didn't need it in the end.
Well, you know, there's no doubt that a more aerodynamic and a better designed shell or outer surface would improve efficiency. There's no question in my mind that would happen. What my position was is that none of the teams, particularly us, have enough finances to really do the development work to make sure that we're doing two things. One, that we're adding surface area to improve efficiency, but we're also not adding any kind of element that would endanger the rider.
Right.
I do not see us as an emerging electric motorcycle industry, or just the motorcycle industry in general, evolving if more people are dying or getting hurt.
Right. Well, you know, just very briefly, Windy Corner on Friday during the senior, you had guys complaining massively, and they do call it Windy Corner, massively of side winds that were blowing them all over the place. And you guys had raced just prior to that. And that is the big concern, the side loads, right?
Yeah, there's several, but yeah. I mean, if nothing else, you're just talking about more surface area that can be affected by more wind. And though the bikes may be slightly heavier, our electric bikes, they still get bounced around. And, you know, go just watch Phillip Island and watch the Ducati, and they'll pull out a nose cone that has, you know, 15 or 20 half-inch or, you know, 12-millimeter holes in them. And you think, really, can that do anything? Really, that's your solution to this? Well, it probably doesn't do a lot, but it's enough to justify doing it. And they're employing that technique. So I just don't think we should cavalier with not being aware of the bigger responsibility. Just go out there and start making huge sheets of fiberglass to cover parts of the bike. Rob Barber, who I really like as well and respect, the whole Agni team, I just, you know, to us, they're still the godfathers of this and deserve all the respect. Apparently didn't have any serious problems with it, thank God. But, you know, it was just my personal position. And you can still be friends with a competing team and take a differing opinion. I think that's part of this. And say, look, that's not how we see the future of motorcycling going. And we want to make sure electrics are the future. And I just, to me, that was, they were at odds.
You didn't completely answer my question.
Well, ask it again. I just messed up. Sorry.
You had mounting points that were never utilized at the TT for clearly for fairings. Did you or did you not have a dustbin fairing at the TT that you were considering possibly using?
We had a dustbin. We decided not to ship it in the end. The fairing mounts that you saw were to carry winglets that we did run on the race day.
Okay.
The winglets got held up in customs. We weren't going to deploy them anyway. We wanted to keep the speculation going. I like that pattern. We will forever show up with surprise on race day at the TT. And We wouldn't have shown them before, but in fact, that's what they were. And if you look at the pictures on the final race day, you'll see that those mounting points are utilized.
Okay. Yeah, actually, Frank, a German gentleman that took a whole bunch of pictures, has some nice high-res photos of your guys' bike when you had it on the front straight, and all those artsy photos were taken coming my way, so I'm looking forward to those. Is there anything that you would have changed this year? As far as the TT went, anything that you think you did wrong, did right, given a second chance, or were you pretty much happy with, obviously happy with the result, but happy with how things worked out?
Yeah, actually, I wish my kids and my wife would have been there. I really wanted my sons to be there. Finances, pressure, stress. I didn't want to put them through another year like the year we had before. It wasn't a fun family vacation. It was a long freaking flight home. I swear, the plane went the wrong way, and we had to circumvent Earth the other direction. besides that, I will say that we were in control the entire time. It was a very low stress event. We made calculated changes. We only changed what we felt we needed to. We didn't have enough. We miscalculated the first session. So, okay, that would have been nice to cross the line, but, you know, that's the first session. I mean, look at the timing charts. Rossi never leads the first session timing charts. He's there doing work, and we were there doing work, and it worked out. But frankly, the only thing I wasn't happy with was the damping on the front. So, Okay. Pretty small, pretty small problem.
If it hadn't gone to plan, well, I know. But we're talking about something that didn't happen, so keep that in mind. Don't get depressed. If it hadn't gone to plan, were you prepared to continue?
It might have been the final straw. And it's not that I have a choice. It's just, if I had the choice and I still had more money, I would continue forever. But at some point, you simply, to me, I guess in that sense, I'm a flawed entrepreneur, because I know a lot of people know when to cut. And it's just not my nature. I just don't want to give up. I just want to, obtain the goals and eventually, in our case, win. I think it would be very difficult to tell people that we are on to new ideas that are actually ideas that can move the sport or the industry forward if we've never completed a race. And at some point, you got to have some kind of evidence that your ideas are valid.
And so taking that forward, and thank you, very, very honest answer. Do you see within a relatively, sensible period of time that you will have something close to a customer bike?
What happened was, the companies we've been working with or talking to or dealing with over the last 6, 12, and 18 months, we told them our plan. We told them our goals, and we achieved them, and all of a sudden, that elevates your stature amongst all the other people they're talking to that also have plans that they're not achieving, and so on. So it's put us in better light. Our business plan right now is not to deliver a pure electric motorcycle, and I don't want to go into too much detail about that, but we do not believe the market is there for the type of bike we would want to produce. But the electric vehicle market is absolutely critical, absolutely important, and we are losing that fight in the United States. I mean, the people used to worry about jobs going to Mexico or going to overseas from Detroit. We're not even going to be in this game. This, of the last 2,000 or 4,000 patents in the EV world, 4 of them have come to the United States. So we're not going to lose. We're going to never have had. I'm a very big believer that electric is the way forward, and that we need to participate. And the bike right now, motorcycles understand that, and that is motorcycle control, throttle, packaging, torque delivery, all that is way more refined on a motorcycle than a car. So if it works well on a bike, it's a no-brainer to go into a car. We've exceeded the car's requirements if a motorcyclist can utilize it.
You've got my brain spinning a little bit, and I can picture some little, 50,000 RPM turbine spinning up a generator to power. I will just say that it sounds like you're talking about a hybrid, and we'll leave it at that. And you don't have to say anything about it.
There's just a lot of great things, and the because it's kind of our core competency, because they're not that big, they don't take up that much space. And because, you know, generally I and most of the team here love them so much, bikes are really great to test a lot of our concepts out on.
Okay.
Eventually, a digital drive or electric drive, that 100% guaranteed should get deployed on a bike as soon as possible. I hope we're involved in that. That is absolutely the way future for a motorcycle and a car, but particularly a motorcycle.
I'm assuming you have patents pending on a fair amount of your technology.
Yeah, we're a little bit behind on that. It's primarily, again, a financial issue. So once those finances start coming in, we can tighten that, which is partly why I have to be so quiet right now, because you can't disclose anything publicly, visually or audibly on a patent before you register it. Otherwise, it's basically invalid.
Well, you're smart, and I actually ask deeper questions than most people do. It's a little bit, can be a little bit dangerous. So when are you going to let journalists test the bike?
Anytime.
Yeah.
Honestly, yeah, the C1 was a scary, scary proposition to have somebody on. It was, you know, it's a lot going on. It's quite overwhelming just to put somebody on that type of bike. This is the opposite. I mean, I just spent 2 days at the track. We were turning somewhere in, I guess, 15% slower than track record pace because we were just testing, just rolling around. There's a lot of people out there. It was a track day. And I felt like I was turning, you know, 50% of the speed of another of the pace setters. So I think that the track record's on 106. We were running around 113 or 119. I felt like I was riding like a 130 lap. I mean, that's how calm the experience is. And that's how easy it is to ride these bikes fast because, in fact, there's less artificial inputs that confuse the rider what's going on. It's just simply turn the throttle to accelerate and roll off the throttle to start decelerating. It's an incredible experience.
Mark was saying that you guys were running basically, and he said he had this drilled into him, that, you know, around 40% throttle and no quick throttle movements on it because that was what knocked the battery power down. Did he stick to that pretty well?
Yeah, he did great. He absolutely did great. We looked at the, I mean, he absolutely followed the plan. The only place he deviated, and we can't even be upset by it because we understand why, was the second practice. That was to be our 100-mile-an-hour lap.
Okay.
We felt that we could obtain it. Even though we didn't finish the first lap, we obviously knew how far we traveled, how much energy was on board. How much we sent it out on a charge, and that was part of our mistake, was the position that we sent him out with energy on board. Anyway, without going into too much details, we actually still validated a lot of information on that first lap. And so we put, you know, our targets together, and he had mentioned that there's yellow tape with little numbers all over, and there's a fair amount to look at and to digest. But we set him on a calibrated rollout on the amperage that would have seen him be able to do just 100 mile an hour lap and get back with a little bit of reserve. He just didn't believe us. You know, he pushed the bike a couple too many times, and he said, "Screw that, man! There's no way these guys know." I heard that before.
Yeah.
And he went out and he tried to bank some, and you can't get it back once you've kind of been too conservative. And so the first, I think probably quarter of the way around, he probably banked about 4 extra miles, and then he started putting the hammer down, and we saw the times fall and the averages move up, and he was doing quite good, but just missed it. And race day, we absolutely knew we could have got the 100-mile-an-hour lap, or close to it. I don't want to say it was easy. It was going to be right there. But, of course, that increased the risk of us having some issue, which you can have, and not making a lap. And at that point, it wasn't worth it. I mean, I had a little bit of a internal fight, and it was like, what am I doing? What am I thinking? I mean, are you kidding? I'll take the win over the 100-mile-an-hour lap any day.
True. Yeah, and he said exactly that. If so let's say that you're successful at Laguna Seca in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
Any thoughts of having a two-bike team next year with you on one of them?
Well, I don't know.
I bet you've thought about it.
You know, I just don't know if we're going to – we'll have to see what happens with the sanctioning bodies and the rules. Everybody's just kind of feeling their way about it. And there's some, you know, real serious organizations behind it now. But, of course, they're new to it. and they've got to kind of see how this sorts out. So I guess we need to see what happens with the schedule. We don't, at this point, wouldn't achieve a lot of benefit from doing mini races. It is hard. This is what people didn't understand about the C1. They got, you know, a couple people got upset. Why aren't we racing? It's like, well, because we're developing.
Right.
And yes, racing does help you develop. It does help you prioritize what the next thing for you to develop is. But when you're in a true raw development mode, racing is a major distraction. We are worried about things and working on things that we already knew that we didn't need to go racing to identify. And anything other than that process of developing would have been a distraction and slowed down the development process. So the electric bike is incredibly stable right now and consistent. And in fact, it is time to put it in some races to learn what the next priorities are. But we wouldn't benefit from doing a lot of races next year. I do have a really interesting plan for Isle of Man that I can't go into lots of detail, but maybe we'll see a second bike there.
Okay. Well, we'll also have to see if I can figure out a way to get up to Oregon or PIR or something and maybe get a little seat time.
Anytime. I assume we're coming close to the end because I'm sure everybody snoozed off by now. And
no, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. We get people writing in saying, I don't care. I'll listen to it twice. I'll listen to it in two different things. People take this on their commute. The hardest core fans listen to this. You would be absolutely surprised. Final question.
All ten of them like it. But I'm sure they're all by now finding that trying to look for that Mark Miller, it's a much more funny and entertaining interview. But I will just say that the experience on the electric bike, and now I can say this, I've got more miles than Mark, and he's one of the most experienced riders. And, you know, I'm one of the few guys probably to have as many miles on the bikes now in the short circuit. It is a phenomenal experience. It exceeded my imagination on what it would be like to go from ICE to electric. And I'm a 100% believer and fan that this is the way forward. And ultimately, we'll deliver a way more satisfying and faster lap time than we could alternatively. It's night and day. We're just at the beginning of it, but it's absolutely clear.
Yeah, no doubt. And one of the things that came to mind when I was thinking about it is I'm like, okay, 40% throttle, 250 foot-pounds of torque. If you there's a point where you can't use all that at all. No way. I'm assuming you guys at some point have lit that thing up just for fun.
So this gets into the area that I'm kind of reluctant to talk about too much, but what you're reading, and I'll tell you this because it's not like it's that difficult to understand, but it is lost by most teams.
Okay.
Or people in the industry. And what you're talking about is engine torque, but what you're talking about feeling is rear wheel torque. And there's gear changes that occur between those. And so you may be able to reduce or magnify that rear wheel torque. Most chains that you've seen put you down somewhere in a 3-to-1 ratio or something. So it's not as violent as that. Yesterday I was going around the corner. I did have signs of traction usage of torque from the tire way closer to the edge of the tire than I've ever used. And I've ridden dozens of DGs and other bikes, you know.
I've seen pictures of you on your Desmo, by the way.
So, you know, pretty decent lean angles. But you take up the bike a little bit before you put on the full throttle, and you can leave huge blackies coming out of the corners, but you don't do that on the edge. On the e-bike, I wasn't leaving blackies, but I was actually picking up the throttle way sooner because the control was so perfect. And as I was taking away lean angle, I was still applying more throttle than I would normally on an ICE bike because it was that connected. And so we were seeing wear patterns way farther on the side of the tire than we'd normally see from, you know, a rider on a normal bike. That being said, we also have throttle mapping, and we don't have traction control yet, but I was coming through and right at that apex, starting to stand on the bike and roll on very aggressive throttle. And before I would be what I would call the exit point of the corner, I was already 100% throttle.
Nice. This is a totally geeky thing, but we have enough, I know, people also into this. What base are you guys writing your own software, and what base OS are you using?
We have a firmware writer that helps us. And frankly, I don't even know what the platform is that he writes with. What we do is we give him very specific parameters that we want to be able to change and control. Okay. So within the firmware, he gives us the parameters. Then we go in and plug into the box and make the parameter changes ourselves.
Okay. And that really was I worked for Netscape for years. I'm a software engineer at heart. I also happen to be a motorcycle racer and a journalist. What a mix, huh?
Well, yeah, maybe two of those kind of fit. One of them really doesn't. Yeah, you should tighten up your software skills. Get up here. There's lots of code to write up here for sure.
That's what I hear. Final question, and not even about the bike itself nor your company, but and I've talked to Mark Neal every so often, but Charge should be pretty cool if it ends with the TT win. Have you talked to Mark in a while?
I do talk to him quite regularly. Of course, I saw him at the Isle of Man. I could not believe that, first of all, we got introduced to each other, and we immediately said, oh, man, he wanted to make another documentary. And, of course, we weren't opposed to it, but we wanted to work with a quality filmmaker like himself. And it was just a match made in heaven for both of us. He gets the thing going, and we start getting a little bit of funding and a little bit of progress. He does some great filming in Portland. We go to the Isle of Man, and of course, we have a complete failure. It's like, I cannot believe that my documentary with Martin Neal is going to end with a big, success of traveling like 3 miles on the Isle of Man.
Well, plus his fastest came along in the meantime, which probably had a fair amount of support from the sanctioning bodies to get completed. But then again, you moved on from year one.
Yeah. So what, we did know, listen, we were aware of what could be the problem. We did that bike in 5 months. And so I don't take anything away from what we achieved in 5 months or what we did. The reality is it's given us the insight to know what really needs to be worked on in the EV world. It's not just the complete vehicle. It's actually some of the components. And they're not just, there are some great components out there for commuting stuff, just not for what we see, for what I or the Moto Sys sees, that a motorsport type quality application exists. So anyway, we did what we did in 5 months, but I still didn't want that as the end to the documentary. So fortunately, we both decided to extend it. And Mark was uber happy with that, better to keep it, probably a little bit fresher and get it out. But there was a lot of other things we were recognizing that was going on with the sanctioning body, and there was changes coming. And actually, I think at this point, he's still planning on coming to Laguna. So maybe there's even a bigger, better ending to come.
Yeah, very cool. That's very cool. Good. MotoGP OD has had plenty of conversations with Mark over the years, and I know that there's one potentially scheduled soon. I'll have to go out and have a beer. Michael, thank you very much. This has been quite enjoyable.
My pleasure. And cool. I'll look forward to listening to all the other interviews on your radio except for this one.
You hate listening to yourself?
Oh, God, do I hate it.
All right. Well, it took me a while to get over it, too. But once again, thanks again. And I'm sure that the audience is going to enjoy it. And we will talk to you soon. Cheers, man.
I'll see you at Laguna. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that was a great interview, or I'm sure it's going to be very strange when we do these time shifts like this. But fantastic. And many, many thanks to Michael Sys and everybody associated with that group, and Mark Miller for providing me with some ammo to ask questions with. Did you read some of the stuff that Mark had asked me to ask?
Absolutely. Yeah, I particularly a very lengthy email, and I very much liked Jules' comment. He said, "Oh my God, we found an American Martin." I thought, oh, "Well, that's a bit actually very honest and well observed." Yeah.
At this point, what we need to do, Martin, is I want to hear, because you were there with your lovely Mrs. to be. Actually, you know what? Let me talk about one thing real quick. News. Let's talk about news real quick before we head into Catalonia. Tell me about and talk to me about this restructuring of HRC with Red Bull, because I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, this is coming in with Red Bull. The point's been made that Red Bull are desperate to get into MotoGP because it's the only World Series or world level motorsport event they don't have a presence in. And the rumour is that they're going to come in and partner Repsol with HRC sponsorship. Speculation, and it is only speculation, that has come from a number of fairly well-informed sources, and I'm sure everyone can guess who we're talking about, would there be potentially a Repsol and Danny side of the pit, and then, Repsol and Danny, and then Red Bull with Dovi and Casey. And again, we're all presuming this three-man super team is going to happen. Interesting. Certainly, I think Repsol have signed on again. They're definitely committed because there was the theory that maybe if Red Bull came into HRC and if Rossi leaves Yamaha and takes Fiat with him, then maybe Repsol would say, oh, Jorge Lorenzo, he's Spanish. He's going to be world champion. Let's get on that bus. But they've signed with HRC again.
I would bet you folding money that within 2 years we'll see Telefonica back in the paddock.
Yeah, and Movistar.
Yeah, yeah.
Talking to some Spanish guys, they say Movistar Movistar, depending on the pronunciation you take, are desperate to get back in. They want a Spanish rider, and they particularly like Jorge. I don't know if they've been connected before. I'm trying to think.
I'm thinking right now is probably the perfect time for sponsors to come back, especially with, as we mentioned before, the rules changes are coming about because the overall bill may not be so high, and especially with the fair amount of the new talent that we have that's probably going to be rolling in there, the salaries may not be so big either. And I always say, get in early, get in often, but we'll have to see. But that'll be cool. I do want to mention this because everybody knows Bob Hayes, or at least those of you that have been paying attention for the show a long time know Bob Hayes. And what I want to do is there's a little bit of news. Bob Hayes got married to a lovely woman named Teresa. He is still in the process of going through training in order to get deployed, but he got married last week. So Bob and Teresa, a virtual throwing of rice at you. Congratulations, you two.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd like to completely echo that. I mean, Bob, for me, his was the first voice I heard on MotoGP OD when I discovered this podcast all those years ago. So fantastic news.
Very, very cool. And wish them the best of luck. And I can't wait till we get Bob back. Have talked to him a little bit on Facebook and a few other places, and through email. Great news. All right, Martin, this is your podium, sir. You are on the top. You were at Catalunya, and
yep.
Fill us in.
Right. Well, I'm guessing that most of our listeners know the result, so I'm just going to whip through how it finished, and then we'll have a quick talk about the race. We'll start with MotoGP. Lorenzo first, Pedrosa second, Stoner third, Randy Depugne, best result of the season yet, fourth, Alvaro Bautista, a fantastic fifth. Amazing. It was hot, it was smooth, the Suzuki liked it. Ben Spies sixth, managed to pip Loris Caparossi and nearly pipped Alvaro Bautista as well. Nicky not so happy in eighth, Marco Melandri ninth, Hector Barbera 10th, Colin Edwards disappointing 11th again, Mika Kallio, flip a coin, is he going to be in World Superbikes or Moto2 next year? Mm-hmm. That's my prediction. In 12th, Kusuki Akayoshi on the Interwetten Honda, standing in for Hiroshi Ayama, was 13th. Andrea Dovizioso, 14th. And just in case anybody doesn't know, he was second. He was chasing Lorenzo. They'd broken away from everyone else, and he lost the front, which we saw. And I was gutted because that had the making of three pairs at the front with a really good battle, and unfortunately lost it. Got back on, no left peg, so he was balancing his foot on the swing arm, and he still managed to overtake Wataru Yoshikawa, who was the final finisher, in 15th on Rossi's bike, Japanese test rider. Bless, he's 41 years old.
Hey.
He raced a MotoGP bike in 1988. I mean, you know, the guys who were in the pits, we were talking to, or not in the pits, sorry, in the grandstand, who we were talking to, saw him finish and said he got off the bike and just stayed bent over for about 5 minutes.
I can well imagine. I mean,
must have been saying, no, no, I've retired. No, no, you haven't. No, no, you haven't retired. No, you've got to go. No, seriously, I've retired. I'm a brake tester. No, you're going to go. We reckon his instructions were, no one's expecting anything from you. Do not bin the bike.
The thing that I've heard that actually makes complete sense to me is that, you know, everybody was wondering about the motivation of the motivation behind the people that they brought up to run until these riders get back on the bikes. And the thing that actually made the most sense to me was that you bring the test riders up, you have them run so that they can have that race experience and actually be able to then step back and do the testing at something closer to race pace, which actually brings better developmental results. And that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I quite understand the sponsors would have liked to see Cal Crutchlow or whoever coming in and making a fist of it. I suspect if you're Valentino sat at home with your foot up mending, you're watching thinking, please don't bin my bike. Please don't use up an engine unnecessarily. Not classified was Marco Simoncelli. Crashed out. Very unfortunate. He was looking like he was going to have a good dust-up with Randy DePugno. And Aleth Espargaró, who really unfortunate. We read in the official program, he did a little speech in there, a little article saying, I've not had good results here. I'm really, now I live 4 kilometres away. It's my home MotoGP. I'm a Catalan. I really, really want to do well here. And he's such a happy, smiling chap. I think everyone felt for him. He looked absolutely devastated on the side of the track.
Absolutely.
You know, air temperature 34 degrees, track temperature 49, and humidity only 17%. That it was hot, but it was dry and hot. There was a gentle breeze, quite comfortable watching. Got a lovely tan.
What is a lovely tan for a Brit?
Oh, no, shush, I'm reasonably golden at the moment. Certainly the lower arms and face and the lower legs.
Photos,
the rest of it's...
Photos required posted on the Facebook.
Oh, yeah, no, they're going to get whapped up. I'm on a day off tomorrow, so I shall throw some up.
All right.
Now, what was interesting, over the weekend, Casey, I have tried really hard to warm to him, and I have warmed to him at times, and then he comes out with... It was broadcast throughout the stadium, his post-qualifying interview. And you know, it's very difficult not to stick, because it rhymes, Mona Stoner. He was whinging about Aleth Espargaró. We saw him gesticulate wildly to the point he nearly looked like he nearly lost control of his bike to Aleth Espargaró because he doesn't like being followed. It's like, oh my goodness, Casey, another bike going the same way, around the same circuit as you. Whatever should we do, you know? For goodness sake, just run your own run. But what was interesting is as he waved in his arms and legs and everything and then went off towards turn 12, Espargaró definitely lifted a left hand from the handlebar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he flipped a bird. Now, utterly pointless thing to do because Casey doesn't have wing mirrors, he can't see you. But there was a ripple of cheers that went round the stand as they saw it. Now, he had his back to us, so we couldn't actually see what the gesture was. But I suspect there was an extended middle finger, and I thought, yeah, that's cool. Interesting, though, Ben Spies was very unhappy with Aleth Espargaró during qualifying. Said, no, he blocked me. He was on the racing line, pootling along. Ben said something a bit strange. He said, I've never done that to anyone, so I'm going to get him back. And I'm like, well, if you've never done that to anyone, you want to stick by that principle, surely you shouldn't do that. But reminding me of Colin's comment at, it was either Indy or Laguna a couple of years ago when Marco Melandri cut him up and he said, obviously he doesn't realise I'm from Texas and I normally carry a gun.
Well, there's no doubt that racers are like elephants. They have very long memories and something will always come back to haunt those that affront them.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. An interesting but slightly sort of specific stat that Jorge Lorenzo became the first Yamaha rider to win 3 consecutive races from pole position since Eddie Lawson in 1986. And he's also one of a very few select riders who've won three races on the bounce. And, of course, so far this season, his worst placing has been second.
Yeah,
he's dropped 10 points from the potential maximum all season. And, you know, consistency speaks for itself.
And he's at this point, even if Rossi returns clearly, he's dropped all the way to, what, seventh, and I don't know how many points out. That's not even a possibility for a championship, but it would only be to perhaps tarnish Lorenzo's, which looks kind of inevitable at this point, frankly.
Yeah, and it must be difficult for him to remain focused and not become complacent. But have you read Jorge's quote where he said, I'm looking forward to Valentino coming back because, you know, I want to beat him in a straight fight. Obviously, this was easier without him there. I like fighting Valentino, but I prefer to win. You know, I like to win even more. And he said, and someone said to him, you know, how do you think it'll be when he comes back? And he said, well, you know, sometimes you have to put your pride on one side because he has to accept that the title's gone. And I thought, woof, that is a gauntlet thrown down right on the ground.
But the thing is, Martin, is that it's fact. I mean,
it is.
It's as damn close to fact as you can get without actually already occurring. And not necessarily who's going to be the eventual winner, because we all know anything could happen between now and the end of the season. But he's just too far out. So it's almost a non-issue, really, at this point. You had you were talking about stats, and I thought that was kind of cool. 81,426 on race day. I thought that I'd heard 90,000-something on television, but you never know. That's still a bunch of people.
That was being flashed up on the screens, and it was also, that's what I found online. The only stat I can find for last year says it was just over 90,000, and I'm sure when we were there last year, we were being told it was 102,000. But in 2008, there were 130,000 at Catalunya. Now, that I find a bit surprising. They're not verified figures. They're basically Wikipedia-type stuff, so that might be complete hoopla. But I was also wondering, do they get their stats from ticket sales or from people through the gate?
My guess is going to be ticket sales. I always think attendance figures are kind of interesting, because I think it's something that the promoters actually end up manipulating to provide a outline of how well the event did. And I always think they're a bit inflated, just a bit.
Well, when I was a young soldier in Germany back in the 80s, if you bought a return ferry ticket, it was cheaper than a single. Mm. So even if you weren't coming back, they'd say, well, get a return, just don't turn up. And the reason was so they could say, oh, look, fully booked, fully booked, fully booked, fully booked, which encouraged people to, you know, book early, and then they committed to the ferry. I don't know if they do the same thing. The stands were certainly... There were more gaps than last year.
I definitely saw some holes in the seating. So,
opposite us last year was the official Rossi fan club, and there was a kind of 80 to 100 person square gap quite visible this year. So I'm guessing they booked and haven't bothered to come because their man's not there.
Well, they were certainly at Misano. You could see them all in the photos that we had there. That was very cool. You had a question here for me, and I can definitely address that just from not only personal experience, but from having paid an awful lot of attention to racing over the last far too many years of my life. You were curious about essentially what we call in the States is drafting and overseas mostly.
Slipstreaming, yeah.
Slipstreaming. And what issues that can cause with engine temperature rising, and therefore leading to a lack of power, because the higher your engine temperature gets, especially as you're starting to get near the zenith of what the bike can take, you actually start losing power. And, you know, Casey was following Danny, and the problem was that maybe his engine would be getting hotter and hotter, and he actually had to pull out of the draft to cool it down. There's no doubt that that's true. If you do get behind another vehicle, not only are you sucking in their heat, you're also not getting a whole lot of fresh breeze. And This is true in car racing as well as bike racing. And yeah. Especially in hotter temperatures, you'll actually see a fair amount of changes actually in some of the aero that these guys will run on the bikes. And even all the way down to, and I remember Liam asking me about this or asking us about this, where they, and in fact, they're doing this on Kenny Noyes' bike in Moto 2, is not even running a front fender so they can get maximum airflow to the radiator. Lots of little tricks and differences they make. Yeah, if you look at the Jack and Jones bike that Kenny runs, you'll notice that there's no radiator on it. Or no radiator. No front fender.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a radiator, it probably would run a bit hot, I imagine.
Yeah, we go back to air-cooled twins. That would be a real hoot. Anyway, that was awesome, and I'm so glad that you were actually there to see it. And you, of course, had the two supporting races, and your weekend was damn full, wasn't it? Because the moment...
Oh, it was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. Last point on the MotoGP was, I owe Danny Pedrosa a silent apology, because he wouldn't have known that there was anything for me to apologize to, because he won't know who the hell I am. But we saw him, we saw the aerial shot at the start. We were around by turns 11 and 12, and he shot off and ran wide. And I thought, well, you've just outbraked yourself. Turns out that his brake pads got displaced because he had a big wobble under acceleration. And when he put the front brake on, nothing happened. And I don't know if you've seen the interviews. But bless him, he's actually becoming quite smiley at times. And he just said, yes, my heart was out here and I was very scared. And I was thinking, no shit.
mean, almost human at times. Yeah.
But the other thing about the post-race interview, I have never heard Casey Stoner being so complimentary about somebody as he was about Danny Pedrosa. And we were just sat there watching it thinking, yeah, next year's teammate then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was just saying, you know, I was pushing really hard and doing all I could, but Danny was great. You know, hats off to him. He did not mention Jorge other than, you know, he got away, Dovi crashed, which was lucky for him. And then all it was how great Danny Pedrosa was, how, you know, he worked really hard, but, you know, he couldn't get through because Danny didn't make any mistakes. So he was really glad to finish, and big smiles. And I just thought, oh, hello, you are PR savvy, certainly in some areas. But no, that was interesting. Before that, chronologically, but we'll move on to it now, we had your axe murderer class. Oh, my giddy aunt. Now, I'd read in the official program, and I'm sad and also relieved to see it. Alex de Bons said he's going to retire at the end of this season. Mm-hmm. He's going to stop professionally racing. And I'd been bigging him up. I like characters, and he's definitely a character. I wasn't aware till I read Lorenzo's book what influence he'd had, how much he'd worked with Jorge. And when Jorge stuffs up the inside of someone when you don't expect him to, I just wonder if Alex de Bons sits somewhere watching that thinking, yeah, my work here is done.
Yeah.
I know. Unfortunately, he didn't cover himself with glory. Moto2 started, hammered down to the first corner. Alex went in a little bit on the hot side. Mike D'Amelio kind of shut the door on him, forced him onto the grass, and as all of us who ride bikes are aware, grass doesn't give the best traction. He's on the inside of the bend. Alex de Bon went down, and he took somewhere between 8 and 11 bikes with him, depending which stat you believe.
Including some incredible tumbles.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, well, Alex himself, I mean, he went end over end. And bearing in mind, he's still fairly busted. This was his first race back after an injury. Mm-hmm. He's fairly busted up himself. In total, there were 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 non-finishers. Now, not all of them were involved in that. Scott Redding, for example, wasn't hit or wasn't knocked off his bike, but he was hit from behind by someone trying to avoid the rest of them, and it did something to his bike because he went from 21st to 15th, back to 20th, and had to retire. Several of them did get up and continue. Mike D'Amelio didn't, Alex de Bon didn't, Robbie Rolfo didn't, and neither did Robertini Pietri.
It was, then we, it was a bit of a mess, wasn't it? I do want to ask you, and just for reference for folks out there in MotoGP OD land, where your seats were and so what view that you had of the circuit.
Right, we're in Stand B, which looks, right, as they come down the back straight, you then get the big red Catalunya. You got the left-hand wide hairpin, which is turn 10.
Okay.
At the end of the back straight. That's the one which on the inside of it is the big red and white Circuit de Catalunya sign.
Yeah. Yep.
As they come round that and then straighten up, they're pointing straight at where we were sat.
Okay.
So then they turn right and right again, then go down to the penultimate corner, down the mini straight to the final corner, where, of course, last year, as I was bouncing on my seat, screaming that Lorenzo had done Rossi, Rossi did Lorenzo. And but again, I mean, we saw this year when Dovi got past Lorenzo, he then got him back somewhere where no one would expect him to do. And it's absolutely like, hey. The Moto2 race was phenomenal. The interesting thing was we had no idea about this, but Iannone, who again was able to cut through, get out front and run on the second lap as they came back round to where this carnage had happened. We just expected red flags. We're saying, well, they've got to red flag it. There's no way they'll clear that in time. And they did. Allowed the race to run, but under yellow flags, and he overtook Yuki Takahashi.
Yeah.
Having watched the Eurosport coverage and the BBC coverage now, the Eurosport immediately picked up on this. And Julian Ryder, Neil Spaulding, and Toby were saying, he's got to give the place up. He's got to give the place up. Now, we were seeing on the big screen Iannone's team holding out pit boards. Now, bearing in mind, we don't know what's happened here. We didn't realise this has happened. And they're holding out pit boards. And we're going, what does an arrow down mean? Look down? Is something hanging? You know, and we were completely baffled. Going, what are they doing? And they're saying, they were saying Taka back or something, or it said Taka down, or it may have been in Italian, I'm not sure, but we were just really confused. Turns out, if he'd given the place back, and this went on for about 10 laps,
mm-hmm.
obviously this debate's going on, race direction will have gone to his team, said he's got to give the place back. He didn't. He didn't see the pit board, or he didn't understand it, and he got a ride-through penalty. Now, we know from James Tozen's experience, you have three laps to come in for that ride-through penalty. That board he understood.
Yeah.
And he went in and, I mean, you could see his body language. That was a very unhappy young man. But he did very well. I mean, he came back and ended up 13th. But that's not exactly what he wanted. But I've got to admit, it was a popular win. Yuki Takahashi, bless him, he has plugged away and plugged away, and he's got his rewards. He rode a cracking race. Thomas Luthi came second, on the Swiss rider on the Interwetten Moriwaki. Julian Simon battled with him, and that was a great little butt dust up they had for pretty much the second half of the race.
No doubt.
Carol Abraham, Tony Elias. Something very strange happened with Tiger. He started well and then went backwards rapidly. I think he was down in double figures at one stage, and then just started coming forward again. So not quite sure what was going on with Tony. Simone Corsi, sixth. Kenny Noyes, seventh. And that's where, I mean, this apps, the whole stand we were in collectively held its breath. It was on the big screen. We watched them coming down to the finishing straight. Kenny Noyes had a wildcard rider by the name of Carmelo Morales on the Tenerife 40 Pons bike, drafting him in the style of Noriyuki Haga, as in absolutely nose to tail. And it's, will Kenny hold on? Will Kenny hold on? And we've had him on the show. You know, most of our listeners are American, so I've got a bit of a bias. And I'm thinking, come on, Kenny, hold it on. And then they touched. And, of course, the bike behind, with a front wheel that moves left and right, is always going to come off worse than the guy in front who's got a rear wheel that's locked into a swing arm. And there was the most horrific crash I've seen since Simon Andrews at World Superbikes. Do you remember when he bounced up the pit wall? And this is basically what happened.
Very, very similar to Andrews' crash, in a way.
Oh, it was hideous. And everyone just went, I mean, you've seen, I'm sure you've seen the film of Antonio Banderas in his pit. Mm-hmm. Absolutely horrified.
Not throwing out a few F-bombs.
Yeah. Yeah, lip reading, quite easy. Interesting. Spanish guy in Spain swears in English. Like it. That's so Hollywood. Yeah, it was absolutely horrific. Now, all we saw was his left hand slap the ground, and then they cut to Takahashi's victory lap. Now, of course, the front runners have got no idea what's happened.
Right.
And I feel really sorry for Takahashi, because he would have had probably been thinking, it's a bit subdued. I'm not being funny, guys. I've just won my first ever race in Moto2. And, yeah, I'm getting a clapping, but we wanted to know what had happened. As it turns out, Morales has got bruised elbow and shoulder. Absolutely miraculous. Because the bike hit him a couple of times, and I was thinking that's broken neck territory. That's horrible. Yeah. And we could not find out. We were all on our iPhones. We were all sod the overseas download charge. You've got to find out what's happened. And, of course, the news feeds were too slow. Now I'm on Twitter. Maybe I could get it quicker. I don't know. But thank goodness he was all right.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is one of those benefits of, well, if you can call it a benefit, but crashing on a straight, frankly, depending upon how you glance off the wall, and it's someplace you don't necessarily want to have things like air fence, that can lead to its own issues, actually, you know, pushing bikes back out on the track. But, you know, you remember Nakano's crash from a few years back on the Kawi when the rear tire flew? And, you know, that was 200-plus mile-an-hour crash. And in essence, he was okay. It's not the fall that kills you; it's the sudden stop, as they say.
Absolutely.
Getting bashed by a bike is no fun either. But that was astounding, amazing, and certainly when you're at a race, when there is an accident that looks like that, your heart's in your throat. So.
Yeah, absolutely, and the gutting thing was as well. He was not given a finishing place because he wasn't in contact with the bike as he crossed the line. Just after he crossed the line, he was in contact with the bike because it whacked him on the back of the head.
Yeah.
But I thought, no, if ever a rule needed a little bit of flexibility being applied to it. But eighth place in the end went to Fonzie Nieto. Props to Anthony West on the MZ, or MZ, coming in ninth. And I'm going to mention 10th place because it's Alex De Angelis, who won't be racing in Moto2 at Sachsenring because he's been promoted to ride Hiroshi Ayama's Interwetten Honda in MotoGP. And I'm thinking, oh, there's a few riders going to be thinking, whoa, hang on, we just got rid of this clown. Why is he coming back? Now, I can understand Tony Elias is leading the Moto2 championship. He wants to be a world champion again.
Yep.
So he doesn't want to go and do that. So why are you picking a guy who couldn't get a ride for this year in MotoGP and isn't exactly setting the world on fire in Moto2? In fact, he's doing pretty poorly. I don't get it. If you're going to do that, stick a test rider in.
I think some of it is also developmental work, because I don't think I've ever heard De Angelis slagged off for not being good at development. Although, of course, his results with Gresini certainly didn't light anything on fire. We'll see. But, yeah, no, your point is extremely well taken about how much his welcome is probably already worn out. And who knows? Who knows? We'll have to see how it comes off. Again, one of those time-shifting things. What's going to happen? I have no idea.
No. As we said, 16 DNFs. Tony Elias made a point this weekend. He said, because they're talking about reducing the grid next year to 36 bikes, he said, you don't have to do that. What you do have to do is make it a 3-bike starting grid.
True.
4 abreast is too many going into that first corner. And then interesting stuff on that, or interesting debate to be had on that. The only other one I've want to quickly mention, because we do have to move on, is Rafael De Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll come back to that in a moment when we talk about the 125s. Finished in 16th. Again, Tectoire, Takahashi's teammate, not doing brilliantly. The reason I want to mention that is because we're going to go on to the 125s, where Mark Marquez, for the fourth race running, went and basically did a Danny Pedrosa.
Yeah, kind of amazing. And it's actually, it's very, very cool to see that happen, because he spent a good portion of the earlier part of this year, kind of, and last year too, if you think about it, kind of struggling.
And he's a great kid. He is a great kid. He's like the Espargaros. He's got a smile on his face. He obviously loves what he's doing. He's a tiny little fella.
Sure.
Which they have, so because the 125s have this minimum bike and rider combined weight, he has to carry ballast.
Yep.
Which actually makes his bike heavier than a lot of the other guys, particularly people like Bradley Smith and Nico Tirol.
Right. It's amazing, and frankly, the way that you have to actually place that ballast is going to vary per track, and you're going to be moving it around. You know, they actually have a rule against this, but I always thought it would be kind of cool is if you could have active ballast that actually moved back and forth to change the center of gravity in the bike. But there is a rule against that. You can't. It has to be fixed.
No.
Which I thought
that would be cool. And interestingly, Takahashi said part of the reason that his bike went so much better this weekend was they put a 3mm aluminium plate to stop the engine moving around. And I thought, shouldn't it be bolted in fairly securely anyway? But apparently, it's made a difference. Bizarre.
Well, they
had Mark Marquez.
They engineer so much. There is so much engineered flex into these bikes. And we look at that as a very rigid platform, and in truth, they are very rigid, but there are certain places where they are designed to flex, and all of that, and every little bit of that, is to give the rider that mythical thing that's called feel, because unless you can tell what the tires are doing, all you're doing is riding around in circles. You have to be able to feel where that edge of grip is, and be able to take it up to that point and not
beyond.
Yep.
But Mark Marquez got the whole shot away and ended up winning by over 4.5 seconds. It could have been more. I suspect he backed off a little bit. Then we had this fantastic three-way battle behind between Bradley Smith, Pol Espargaró, and Nico Tirol. And it was like every lap, someone different was leading that little group. And then I was thinking, oh, Bradley, it hasn't gone that well. He's generally ended up at the back of the group he's been fighting in the last few races. He has been unlucky, and possibly he has made the odd mistake. He'd actually, on the last lap, he'd got himself in front as they came into sight in the stadium area, coming round turns 10, 11, 12. Nico Tirol ran wide, and Pol Espargaró was fighting through, or pushing through, and he had a mini high side, and Tirol failed to finish. He DNF'd. He crashed. Interestingly, he actually was quite badly hurt. He's had very severe bruising. He was taken in for scans because they were concerned about his lungs and some of his internal organs. Sounds like he's okay, but very, very badly bruised on his back. He was basically slammed into the deck.
Exactly.
No one likes to see that. But the flip side, obviously, is Bradley came second. Pol Espargaró third. Sandro Cortese was fourth, and he was 40 seconds behind third place.
We always end up with that in the 125s. You get these breakaways, and then the packs can't catch back up. We don't always get that, but we have seemed to get that more this year, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And Efren Vasquez, who's had a couple of dust-ups with Bradley so far, was fifth. The only other person I think really we need to mention is Johann Zarco, because you like names that start with a Z. But I've got to mention Randy Krumanacker, because that's just such a cool name.
Very, very true. Very true. Yeah.
I probably should have mentioned Ratapak Willerot as well in the Moto2. Interesting. And just going back to my mention of De Rosa, news in Motorcycle News this week, that Bradley is reported to have been talking to VDS Racing, which is Scott Redding's team, and Tech Trois about a possible Moto2 ride next season. I'm thinking, Tech Trois, which one of those riders might be getting dropped?
De Rosa.
So I'm thinking, come on, Aspart, give the boy an offer. He should have moved up this year, I think, because I think he's too big for the 125. You know, he unfortunately, he didn't get the shout. So
Yeah, I agree with you too. I think that'll be a lot of fun to watch. And I, DeRosa was so hot at the end of last year, and in 250s, and it's kind of been weird to see him. Well, both he and Takahashi have had all sorts of troubles on the Tech 3 this year, and giving Hervé Poncharal fits. I mean,
no, absolutely,
to the point of where he was tearing his hair out, and he doesn't have a whole lot to tear out. So, great. There goes our one interview opportunity with Hervé Poncharal.
I think he was entirely justified.
I do too. You have to have results, and you can't just keep bashing the hell out of bikes over and over.
And I think the one that was Qatar, when he said, all I asked them to do, I didn't expect them to win. I didn't say you've got to come in the top this, top that. But, I just said to them, don't crash.
Yeah, it's just
about crashed.
All right. So, fantastic times in Catalonia. You and Sharon had a wonderful time, I bet. And it was nice getting a little bit of time off, except for having to come home to a lovely classic UK weather, right?
Yeah, and we had a hell of a journey home. Plane was delayed an hour, then we landed in the one bridge that gets you from Liverpool. No, it's just, you've landed, you're an hour late, you're thinking, if you want to end it.
You just want to get home, right?
Yeah. If someone wants to end it, that's fine, but why involve the rest of us? So then we drive it. Then we find out they're resurfacing the road near the dual carriageway near our house, so we had to go through the villages, so we didn't get home until sort of 3 in the morning, and it was like, thank you. But no, it was a brilliant weekend. Thoroughly enjoyed it. It's Sharon and Mai's place. It was the first overseas MotoGP I went to last year, and just, I can't see us ever stopping going.
Now, in the entire weekend, did you run into any MotoGP OD fans?
No, mainly because I'm an idiot. of course, all I'd said was where the stand was. Well, if you're not in that stand, you can't get into that stand. So, yeah. No, absolutely not. And I quite appreciate in the States, you guys will take the time and say, right, we're going to be here. But I was with a bunch of guys and with Sharon, and I thought I can't commit them to go and just stand by a lamppost with me somewhere possibly distinctive. The paddock walk was interesting. On a Friday morning, we got to go through the paddocks. Sharon's got a lovely photo with her and Loris, and he didn't seem to mind the fact she was wearing a VR46 hat. and we saw Ben Spies, and Jorge played the crowd wonderfully and kept us all waiting and then came out. And Colin was funny, predictably. All the Spanish guys spoke, and it was good. It was really good.
Cool.
What got me with the bikes are so small.
Oh,
even
yeah.
The MotoGP bike, when you see them in the flesh there, you're like, you're really tiny.
Yep.
You're like a 600.
They are wee. All right. We did have a test at Imola, and we had some interesting times from that, but not anything, frankly, ground-shaking. And those results are online. We just run through, say, the top five, which was Crutchlow, Fabrizio, Haslam, Ray, and Haga. We also had some of the World Supersport guys out there, and the times they were running were good, but I think they were having some interesting kind of weather issues there. Max Biaggi wasn't real quick, but you never know what they're going to be doing with testing and whatnot. So it very well could be having new bits. I did hear a little bit of a whisper today, Martin, that Aprilia, now I'm not even going to further that. I'm going to cut that out, in fact. I heard that Aprilia may be in some trouble right now, or at least in the U.S. We'll have to see. But Piaggio is a huge company. I'll cut all that.
Financial trouble?
Potentially. They had a very big stock drop today on their report of sales. But it was, well, not big, but it was like 6 or 7%, which is enough to make people go, hmm. Back into it.
Right.
I'm going to rip through this because we are running out of time here.
Absolutely.
Back at Brno, we also had Fabrizio and Haga, and for once they were both ahead of the Satellite Ducks, which was very cool. And you asked a question and I thought was very interesting. Are they getting their mojo back? I don't... Fabrizio,
it's
I'm not...
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he lost it. Nori, I'm really not sure what the deal is there, and it still kind of worries me, especially having seen and talked to him at Miller. We'll have to see how that goes. Last year, results for there. We had race one was Biagi Checa Ray, race two was Spies Biagi Fabrizio, and we always will remember Fabrizio taking out Ben Spies in race one. But we should also point out for Brno that, especially with the current resurgence of, not resurgence because we never had a initial surgence, but the results that Troy Corser has been having lately. And if you remember last year at Brno, Corser led both races for the first couple of laps.
Yeah, and he was 5th and 10th, wasn't he, I think, last year.
And Ruben had that rather heinous-looking crash. But Brno's a neat circuit, except for Martin. It's going to be hot. It's going to be hot kind of like the heat you had in Catalonia. So that will be an interesting thing. I think it's 31, 32 on race day. I'm not sure what that would translate to as far as track temperature goes, but I'm sure it's going to be high.
I would nail Max on for podiums on both races, I think, because he loves that place and that place loves him. But I think that Leon is very aware that if he's going to have a shot at this championship, he has got to get in front of that Aprilia.
Indeed, and that also means that he needs to come back on the show again because he will recharge his mojo.
Absolutely.
No doubt, and that's all for me not making the attempt right now, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Corser on the podium again. And again, this is something that you and I talk about all the time, is what lets down the yes thou at the end of a race. Well, it seems like they may be starting to get some of that conquered, and if that's the case, it would really make for an interesting last part of the season, I think.
Oh, definitely. I like to have that sort of thing in the spoilers. Cal Crutchlow's been playing it. You know, Johnny Ray's been playing it. I don't think either of them can really challenge for the title now. They're too far behind. Maybe Johnny, if he had a really good run, but they can throw a result out there that just throws, you know, an element of randomness into the mix.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, very much looking forward to it.
I actually heard a rumor that Yamaha was going to run a third R1 this weekend with Rossi in sterile garter leathers. So I thought that would be kind of cool.
Yeah, let's throw that one out there. That's a really good one to start, actually. Yeah.
Or the Stig, whichever one actually showed up. Okay, well, clearly, yet once again, a incredibly long show, and that's very cool. And, Martin, it was good to be back this week.
Absolutely, yeah. I was the same last week. It was like, wow, it's cool to be back. And it was really cool for me and Jules. We'd never actually spoken before.
I found that funny. I would have thought, you guys, you know, I listened to the show, of course, and you guys were mentioning that, you know, exchange hundreds of emails, but you never actually talked.
No, and we know each other's voices so well because we've heard each other on the show. But yeah, really bizarre, but fantastic. Really enjoyed it.
And you did a great job on the show. I thought it was very cool.
Oh, thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, absolutely.
I shall have a celebratory Guinness in that case.
Again?
Yeah, because I think I might deserve it.
All right. Well, Martin, thanks again. My best to you and the family. And we will come back and we will talk again next week. In the meantime,
likewise,
due to our time shifting necessities, I'm going to do the interview with Michael.
That we heard earlier.
Isn't that amazing? We should patent that, shouldn't we?
I feel like Doctor Who.
Indeed. All right, Martin. Cheers. Thanks a bunch, man.
Cheers, Jim. Good night, all.
Good night.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.